across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Sonner Kurt. Sonner is a United States Coast Guard graduate. We're going to talk about her Coast Guard career a little bit, but we're also going to talk about some of the writing that she does as an investigative reporter for the War Horse, and in particular, a story that she recently wrote about aging veterans. Sonner, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Well, how did a nice New Jersey girl like you end up at the Coast Guard Academy?
Yeah, I had always been interested in military service. My father was a Navy veteran before I was born, but, you know, I kind of knew that was part of his service or his story. And I just thought, you know, I heard his story sort of adventures and the friends he made, and always thought that would be a cool thing to do. You know, I grew up sort of, even though I grew up in New Jersey, my family spent a lot of time on the Chesapeake Bay down in Maryland, so I was familiar with the Naval Academy. And for a long time, thought that's what I wanted to do. But ultimately, the Coast Guard, I ended up going to the Coast Guard Academy in part because at the time it was the only service where every job was open to women. And so I liked that opportunity, and I liked the humanitarian and environmental mission, and the fact that it was kind of, you know, still the military, but a little bit unique, a little bit different. So I graduated from the Coast Guard Academy and then served as an officer for a while before eventually turning to journalism.
So you were at the Academy from 2005 to 2009 and then got out of the Coast Guard in 2014. So tell us a little bit about those, you know, 4 or 5 years in uniform with the Coast Guard, about some of your experiences, because some of them are kind of cool.
Yeah, I loved my time in the Coast Guard. I mean, you know, at the Academy, I had a whole bunch of opportunities. I got to sail on the Coast Guard Academy's training ship, which is sort of like a traditional tall ship.
Yeah, tall ship. Yeah. Sails and everything. The Eagle,
exactly.
I believe, yeah.
The Eagle, right. And so, you know, we were scurrying around up in the rigging, you know, physically pulling up the sails by hand. So that was really cool. And I spent some time on a buoy tender, so a ship that kind of services all the aids to navigation as a cadet, as well as a law enforcement ship out of Key West. And then when I graduated, I went to the Coast Guard Cutter Healy, which is one of three polar icebreakers that the Coast Guard has.
See, I told you some of this assignment was cool. This is it.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique thing. Sometimes I wonder if I, you know, peaked at age 22 in terms of the interesting things that I got to do. But yeah, so I did two sort of 5-6 month deployments up to the Arctic on that.
Well, and in a time where we're talking about
climate change and polar ice caps melting and what's it doing to the wildlife up there. You got a chance to see that, see what real ice is about and what polar bears and everything else is, I suspect, during those deployments.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually, you know, seeing polar bears in the wild was probably one of the top experiences I'll ever have. But yeah, a lot of, you know, the Coast Guard actually provides kind of the primary platform for Arctic research if you're really going up into the polar ice cap, because you kind of need an icebreaker, a ship that can crush through the ice to get there. So we would, you know, deploy with a Coast Guard crew, but then a rotating cast of scientists. And a lot of them were doing sort of all sorts of research related to climate change, looking at sort of the history of the ice there, the history of melt. We even did a mission with NASA that sort of had to do with, if I'm remembering correctly, how you know, the changing polar ice cap up there sort of affected the light refraction, affected satellites. Yeah, you know, getting to see that 10 years ago and sort of have some of the conversations with researchers that we're having now, kind of more broadly in terms of, you know, what's happening to the ice up there was a pretty formative experience, I think.
Well, and it sounds like it ripples forward to your journalism career, because you've not only write for The War Horse, but also your articles have been in New York Times, Wired Magazine, The Verge, Inside Climate News, and other sort of publications. So your interest in the environment, which you had going into the Coast Guard Academy, mm-hmm. and certainly got a view of that in the real world when on a cutter, an icebreaker, continues forward. I should say that when you got out, you got your a master's in at Georgetown in democracy and government studies, and then subsequently got, I believe, a master's from UC Berkeley in journalism. And that's kind of the career that you've taken off for, and has turned you into a California girl instead of a New Jersey girl, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I came out here for journalism school maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and I was just, you know, there's water, there's mountains, there's sunshine every day. so I decided to stay.
Well, boy, the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce is going to give you a call. let's turn to this article that captured my attention, and I'm sure that of many others. And maybe we start with, why did this topic capture your attention to write on it, to research on it, about the, you know, that America's facing this time of aging veterans and what it's going to do about it? Why did that capture your attention?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of good that, or nice that we started with my personal background, because this story actually had a sort of personal impetus. So, you know, I mentioned my father is a veteran. He flew A-4s sort of during the Vietnam era. And he's someone who got out of the military. He used his GI Bill to go to architecture school. And then, you know, in the 45-ish years since then, he wasn't really involved with the VA at all. He didn't get healthcare through them. He didn't have any, you know, disability payments. He didn't, you know, interact with sort of the veterans system at all. And as he started to age, there were things sort of, we realized in retrospect that he could have used help with. For instance, you know, he ended up with hearing aids and only realized retroactively that VA might have been able to pay for those. And then during COVID, he was diagnosed with dementia. And I just started doing a lot of reading about Alzheimer's and realized that veterans are sort of disproportionately exposed to some of the risk factors for Alzheimer's and other dementias. And I just thought, you know, my family can't be alone in facing this. There were, when we think about veterans from World War II, even Korea, right, it was a much bigger sort of swath of the population that served. The idea that you had the service in your background was kind of common, whereas, you know, Vietnam and certainly afterwards, a lot of people served their time, and then it was kind of, you know, okay, I'm done with that. I don't really know that many other people who have served, and I'm not really thinking about life in terms of me being a veteran. And then when you kind of reach an age where maybe you start to need a little bit more support, more medical assistance, there's this sort of whole infrastructure that you're not used to dealing with that maybe can provide some support. And so it was really through you know, my experiences with my dad that I realized, I think there's a story here. I think a lot of people are facing the same thing. And how are we caring for this generation of veterans who really represent sort of a different group than World War II veterans as they age?
Absolutely. I'm glad we're talking, because I wouldn't have gotten that out of, I didn't get that out of the story, right? That's why you have these discussions with these journalists to say, well, kind of what motivated you to do it? And it's interesting because it's a common story. People get out, they get on with their life, they're doing okay. And maybe it's a job loss, maybe it's something else, maybe it's a disease process that they have to begin thinking about other avenues. And there are things that, unfortunately, veterans have higher incidences of. And one of them is ALS, another one's diabetes. And your article points out that cancer is another one that has a disproportionate number of veterans in the grouping. And it's probably because of what you're toxically exposed to, all the chemicals and fumes and everything else, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. About, 50,000 cancer cases are reported among veterans annually. And obviously, as veterans get older, that's likely to rise. And a lot of those are lung cancer, skin cancers, which sort of suggest that that there's an exposure element here. You don't join the military sort of with a warning, about occupational hazards sort of later in life.
Right. Well, and you're 20 year old, you're healthy as a horse, and it's only 40, 50, 60 years later that maybe some of this shows up. And you write that things like TBI or toxic exposures may be risk factors for Alzheimer's and other dementias. And we think about all of the Afghanistan vets who were exposed to toxic fumes from burn pits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at them 30 years from now. Are they going to have an increase in Alzheimer's or other dementias? It really gives you some policy things to think about, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're on the right track sort of finally for helping those, younger veterans who have been exposed in terms of, one, getting the benefits, but also sort of, tracking who was exposed. And some of the things that have come out of the advocacy around burn pits, like, every veteran now should be getting a toxic exposure screening when they go to the VA, basically. Like, there's a lot more acknowledgement that people are exposed to things in their military service, whether or not it was burn pits specifically. But looking back, when my father and other sort of Vietnam era veterans were in, that wasn't the case. Obviously, it was an uphill battle for Agent Orange, but there were a lot more chemicals. And so I think we're moving in the right direction in terms of sort of being a little bit more proactive about protecting veterans after they've been exposed. But retroactively, that's, looking back, that's not the case.
And even thinking, I think we're doing a better job now in the nation and the VA about thinking about the exposures. PFAS is another good one, that all those Navy boys got exposed to, because that's the firefighter foam you used on the ships and on the planes to make sure that the worst didn't happen, which is fire on a ship. Lots of exposure from may just be from training incidences, and we have to think about, as people age, what that's going to relate to, because you talk about we have a changing demographic, don't we, with our aging veterans?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I found in my reporting that I didn't really think about going in was that who actually served in Vietnam, Desert Storm, versus who served in sort of World War II is very different. Like, even just the admitting women into the services means that there's going to be an almost 240% increase in women veterans over the age of 65 by 2041. And obviously, female veterans have different healthcare concerns. They have different medical concerns. They have a lot of the same ones, but they have different ones than male veterans do. And so, even sort of opening the aperture to think about who served and what does that mean for the sort of care we need to provide is changing.
Well, and as you write about how veterans are living longer, the whole population is, which means these certainly some of these disease processes get to grab you a little later than if you had knocked off when you were 50. And veterans survive problems, you know, exposures, accidents, combat injuries. They survive them more today than they did during Vietnam, and certainly more than they did under World War II. So you have both of those things working in an older population of veterans.
Yeah, and that was, again, something that I hadn't thought about. And I talked to Scotty Hartnoroft. He's the head of geriatrics and extended care at VA, that's sort of taking on the bulk of figuring out how to care for this sort of more diverse population as it ages. And that's what he said. You know, a lot of people have survived something that wouldn't have been survivable in earlier conflicts. And I think it's important to think about that, you know, both in terms of their sort of acute and chronic medical needs, but also mental health needs. You know, surviving something traumatic has an impact on you. And today, when veterans are in this, you know, when people are in the service and afterwards, there's a lot more focus on making sure people get mental health care. But in older veterans who served a while ago, those resources might not have been available when they got out of the service, you know, to deal with whatever it was that they ended up surviving. And that can have ramifications sort of down the line when they're older.
I'm interested in sort of the change in approach that you've outlined in the article and probably researched as you went through this. And, you know, states have had veteran homes since the Civil War. And that whole concept has kind of changed over time. That, well, we'll just warehouse these guys. And they were almost always guys in these state veteran homes. Are not really state of the art, but they're you know, funded by the state, a given state. But we're moving to a different kind of module or model of how you deal with aging veterans. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, right. This idea that, you know, here's sort of a place to put people is no longer sort of the dominant way of thinking, which I think is really, really helpful. I think, you know, as this is a conversation that's happening not just in VA and sort of the veteran space, right? But as baby boomers age, that generation tends to, you know, be a lot more active, longer, involved in community, their family, you know, things outside of the home a lot longer. And so the idea of sort of like you get older and that means you just kind of get put away where you can get care, you know, doesn't really jive with people's lived experiences. And it can cost a lot of money for not necessarily, you know, the best returns in terms of health and longevity. And so one thing the VA is doing is really expanding sort of its programs to support veterans staying at home as long as possible as they age. So for instance, there's a VA program, home-based primary care, where VA helps connect veterans who are living at home with a primary care team, so a doctor, a nurse, physical therapist, even social workers, sort of, you know, who can go into the home and sort of help provide whatever it is someone needs to continue living at home, whether that's sort of acute medical care or even just sort of, you know, fighting social isolation, expanding veterans. Basically the ability of veterans to use providers in their own community with support from the VA, that's being expanded. And then even when people have a medical condition where maybe they can't stay at home, VA is expanding a program called medical foster homes, where basically instead of living in like a veteran's home with a bunch of other people, you'd live in like a small private home with just one or two other veterans and a caregiver. And so the model, both in the veteran community and more broadly, is moving away from sort of institutions where possible, towards creating sort of a web of support around people to stay at home as long as possible.
And there seemed to be in your writing some recognition of there's pretty wide diversity of veteran populations from, you know, up north, down south, those around bases, rural, and VA is trying to take all that into account as it thinks about how do we deliver the care that veterans are owed as they get older. So the location's a big issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, VA and its sort of clinic model really expanded after World War II based on sort of where World War II veterans were. And obviously, you know, those demographics and geographies have changed as we have different people serving, you know, the country changing. And so the reality is that not every veteran has access, you know, has immediate access to a VA clinic. And so by trying to, you know, think one thing that Dr. Hartromp said was sort of this two-pronged approach the VA is thinking about in terms of one being sort of more agile, more flexible with these things like veteran-directed care, where you can, you know, a lot of veterans can have a stipend to hire local caregivers, and things like that, where you don't necessarily need to, you know, have immediate access to a clinic. So being sort of more flexible on that, and then two, really letting people know that even though you might not have been going to a VA clinic for care, even though there might not be a clinic or a medical facility right near you, there are still things you can benefit from. So this idea of just like advertising to people what's out there, and again, to kind of make it personal, you know, just the other month I learned that that VA will pay for my father to attend like a dementia care daycare center 2 days a week. I didn't know that. So there's a lot of benefits that VA is trying to get the word out as this population
That idea of making sure the veteran with dementia can go off to a daycare center is for a couple of days is really important for the caregiver. It's a recognition by VA that, you know what, we need to give the caregiver some time off as well. And I'm glad you brought up kind of back around to your dad. I was wondering if I could ask, how's he doing? Mm-hmm. How's the family doing with this? Have you learned some things through this research that you can apply at home? And you just identified one. So tell us how he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, you know, I didn't do this for a selfish reason, but it's been helpful. Unfortunately with Alzheimer's, it kind of only goes in one direction, but having the ability for him to go somewhere a couple days a week, really is giving my mom, who's his primary caregiver, some time off, which is really needed. And I think in terms of this idea about like creating a web of support and that allows people to live at home for longer, a lot of that really has to do with supporting the people who support or give care in their daily lives. And so I think VA is really acknowledging that, but yeah, my dad, you know, he's still great. He's still happy and funny as this disease sort of progresses, one of the things that sticks with him is his medical time, or sorry, his military time. And it's something he's actually talking about more and more, sort of his time in the Navy, his Navy buddies. I don't know if that's because it's sort of so important in this moment.
My guess is that he'd still recognize photos and models of the A4 that he flew.
yep, 100%. Yeah, and he has a model up in our family room and loves to show it off when people come over.
I used to fly that. We're talking to journalist Sonner Kurt. She writes for a number of folks, including The War Horse. She wrote on the aging veteran population and VA's response to that. I kind of read this and thought, I felt good. I felt like the VA is reacting to this on all kinds of different fronts and isn't waiting to be, you know, isn't a classic bureaucracy that can't move forward on something. Is that the sense you had, and is that the sense you were giving in the article?
Yeah, you know, I'm an investigative journalist by trade, so I'm hesitant to be too optimistic about anything. I'm sort of skeptical by nature.
Pure skeptic.
Yeah, exactly. But no, the VA like absolutely recognizes this is a thing that is happening and wants to be on sort of the leading edge of that. You know, by expanding these programs, by sort of saying, here's where we're going to focus our efforts, you know, on keeping veterans at home as long as possible. And when they do have to, if they do have to go into sort of a care facility, trying to make that as home-like as possible. I think that they recognize this and really are trying to make an effort. You know, it's a big bureaucracy. Whether that trickles down from the top, I think, you know, to the veterans most needed, I'm very hopeful, but, you know, that's always an open question.
See, I knew the cynic investigative reporter would seep out of Sonar here. I'm glad we came back around so you got your street creds with your investigative reporter types.
I don't want to seem too optimistic, right?
Sonar, thank you for taking some time with Veterans Radio today to talk about this important issue, because over time it becomes more important and evolving issue. So we really do appreciate your time on this today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for taking the time to cover it. I think it's a really important issue.
And if people want to follow other things that you've written and are writing, where should they go?
The best place is The War Horse, which is thewarhorse.org. You can read my work there and sign up for our newsletter, which kind of tells you every time we have both a journalism story and we publish first-person reflections from service members and veterans as well. So that might be interesting to the audience.
Again, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Jim.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Press Corps Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.